The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome in to Students of the Game. My name is Alex Fatman, joined by my co-host today, Nathan Gladwell. Nathan, we've got a ton of topics to go through this week, focusing on college football, the NFL draft, the NBA playoffs, what happened in round one. But let's start talking about college football. And the two teams we're going to focus on today are based in the SEC. First with Texas. This past weekend, it came out that Texas had a $35 to $40 million budget on their football roster for this upcoming season. And they really snuck it in there because with the revenue sharing cap coming in, it'll be around $20.5 million per school in the first year, and it could increase to $30 million over the next decade. But with the limitation coming in next season and Texas kind of squeaking in there and being able to put almost $40 million towards their football roster, where you have teams, lesser teams, like in the American Conference, Conference USA, conferences like that, they don't have $40 million to even spend on their entire athletics program. But Texas has the ability to go in and spend that on just their football team. And there's no telling what the budget was for the men's basketball program, the baseball program, women's basketball. I mean, all those programs are on the up and up. So Texas has really squeaked it in here and spent all the money they could right before the budget and the salary cap is implemented. But Nathan, how is this fair for other teams around the country where they don't have the $40 million budget to spend on a football team where Texas does?
Well, it's not fair. But other than life is not fair. Texas as a whole has so many different sponsors, and you look at Texas and where they're located. It's oil capital of the United States. You can drive out to Texas and see oil rigs. It's all that out there for miles and miles and miles. So they have that rich oil money out there, and people who are willing to spend it. I don't want to be too harsh on Texas because they're not the only tool. I talked about Oregon this previous offseason a lot heavily, especially with Nike and Phil Knight, about how much money they are willing to put into the Oregon football program. Well, you have the same people around Texas that support Texas who are Texas alum who want to put back into the university. So I don't feel like I should be as harsh towards Texas for having the money to spend. That's not their fault. It's the fault of the NCAA for not already having a cap implemented to level the playing field. So it's a smart decision. I'm sure Steve Sarkisian, he's you know, debated and really squeezed out every little penny he could from all the alum to make sure that their football program is properly sponsored. And you look at some of the athletes they're able to secure. It's a big part of it. It's just being able to pay them more and offer more than other schools. So I don't think we can be as harsh towards Texas or any other school if this were to happen to them, just because this does not fall into their hands. They're not in the wrong for doing this. They are just taking advantage of what is able to happen. So if you want to see effects on, you have to get to the NCAA and demand them to start actually doing their job instead of sitting on their hands, because they're very good at doing that.
Yeah, it's hard for them to get to do their job. But looking at it as a whole, I mean, you're going to implement the salary cap next year, but $20 million. There is schools in Division I right now that don't have $20 million to spend. So even with that salary cap, it doesn't seem it's going to be even leveling the playing field at all, because you're going to have, let's just take a program in Sam Houston State, who's new to the Division I when it comes to football, and you have Texas. Sam Houston State, while they're in the state of Texas, doesn't have the money that Texas has. They don't have $40 million or even the $20 million to spread across their athletic program. A lot of athletic programs around the country are actually operating in a deficit when it comes to incoming and outgoing money. So while you're putting this $20 million salary cap in place, there's teams that can afford the $20 million, and there is way more teams that cannot remotely afford $20 million. So the NCAA has to figure out different avenues of a way to level the playing field, whether it's putting the teams that can actually spend that $20 million in their own division, or if it's limiting the amount of players they can offer or get when it comes to ranking-wise. I don't know what that looks like. But the NCAA, when they opened the NIL and the transfer portal floodgates, there was no rules and regulations. It was just, okay, we're putting this out there. We've been sued way too much. Have at it. And they sat on their hands like you're talking about, Nathan, and didn't do anything about it. And we're sitting here, what, a decade later? And nothing's been done about it. And they're just taking small baby steps. And while that's great, taking small baby steps to reach their end goal, this should have been done as soon as it was announced. The baby step should have been taken day one, where, okay, here's rule one. This is what we're implementing. The salary cap should have been implemented day one. It shouldn't have been, here's NIL 10 years down the road. Oh, now we're implementing a salary cap because we realize that these lower tier D1 programs can't stick with the upper tier D1 programs. It's not fair to them. And life's not fair. But at the end of the day, you have to make this college athletics fair, or it's going to turn into the MLB where you have the Dodgers and the Yankees and the Mets, who are the big market teams, spending the most money.
Those are pretty bad.
Well, I mean, they spend the most money regardless of how good or bad they are. And it's not fair to other teams like the A's, the Athletics, and other teams like that that don't spend the money or have the money to spend it. So the NCAA has to decide, do you want to be the MLB or do you want to be like the NBA and the NFL where there's a salary cap to limit things like the MLB has and like we're seeing in the NCAA right now. But Nathan, you look at Texas and going forward, what is the expectation going into the season, having spent $35 to $40 million on the roster? Is it national championship or bust, or is it get to the Final Four of the college football playoff? What's the expectation for Texas and Steve Sarkisian?
If I was a Texas fan, I would say national championship or bust. But inside the Texas football program, it's, you know, it's spending money to get good players is just one part of the puzzle, because it's then about being able to develop them and making sure you coach them well and making sure you have the right packages in and really squeeze out all of what the player has to offer. Because talent only goes so far and skill only goes so far. It really depends on how the coach utilizes the player. So do they have the players to go and win the national championship? Absolutely. And would it be a disappointment if they didn't win it? I think most fans would consider it, given the fact that they've spent that much money. But if you're within the program, if you're Steve Sarkisian, while you do want to win a national championship, you understand how hard it is in this day and age to just load up a roster like this and go and run the table. Ohio State was able to do it last year, but they had multiple cases where they didn't look like the best team in the country. And it's easy to just slip up and losing one game in the playoffs and you're out. So it's about being able to take advantage of the situation you're in. And as far as everything in the offseason that they have been able to do, I think they've capitalized on that. Now it's just about going forward through, summer and making sure you're practicing well and then going into the fall. I know their schedule is not particularly easy. So a lot of opportunities to slip up, just about focusing in. But I would say national championship bust for this team, just based on the amount of money they had spent and where they were last year.
I have to agree. A lot of it rests on the shoulders of Arch Manning. And we talked about it multiple times on the show. One player doesn't win or lose you a football game, but when it's your quarterback and he hasn't started a full season, he had experience here and there with Quinn Ewers having injuries and missing games the past couple of seasons. But Arch Manning, this is going to be his first full season starting at the quarterback position at Texas. There's a lot of question marks around him. Is he going to be able to prove it? He played in a lower tier classification in Louisiana, so there's kind of question marks around the competition level he's played at. He's shown flashes at Texas, but he's also shown his youth and his need for growth. But Steve Sarkisian is the type of coach where he can get the best out of any player. We saw when he was at Alabama and how great the offense was under him with Nick Saban as the head coach. But Texas is going to rest a lot on Arch Manning's shoulders. Can he prove he's going to be the next best quarterback or the best quarterback in Texas history? Or is he going to falter and kind of help hold this team back when it comes to the end of the day? Because Texas does not have a great backup. If Arch Manning gets hurt or Arch Manning struggles, there's not somebody they can turn to and go, okay, this is going to win the national championship. It's not like last year where Quinn Ewers went down or Quinn Ewers was struggling. You can go to Arch Manning and expect him to come in and go, okay, Arch Manning can kind of pick up the slack. He gives us another weapon. Texas doesn't have that at the backup quarterback position when it comes to experience, athleticism, and all that stuff. Texas has a big mountain to climb, but they've spent the money. They have the talent. They have the best offense in mind in college football. And if they don't win a national championship, it's a very big disappointment. Flipping over from Texas and moving to Alabama, this spring portal, Nathan, there's a lot of question marks about, does a quarterback hit the portal? Do we see the loser of the QB battle hit the portal? Is there going to be Saban's leftovers out the door? What's going on with the roster under Kalen DeBoer in his second year? But the transfer portal window in the spring came and went, and no Alabama player entered. They're the only team in the Southeastern Conference that did not have a player hit the portal. How big is that for Kalen DeBoer going into year two, Nathan?
Well, I think it's pretty insane given the fact that last year you lost basically the entire team after Nick Saban left. But I think it really displays what kind of culture Kalen DeBoer has been able to install in the short period of time he's been the head coach at Alabama. And really instills a lot of confidence in me that he has a plan in place to go and succeed and to win a national championship. I think you saw that last year in certain games, and obviously with the shortcomings, I mean, that was there. But you in the good, if you looked at the good, if I was a student athlete, I would say that would instill a lot of confidence in me. So I think you got to give a lot of credit to Kalen DeBoer and the staff he's built, and then being able to deal with losing people to the draft. That's a big part of it. And then being able to, on the flip side, being able to recruit new people in, not only through the transfer portal, but in regular recruiting as well. That's a big thing. And then the last thing, being able to hire good coordinators, bringing back Ryan Grubb. I think that was a big thing to help with this offense that didn't really look the greatest last year and definitely had its own shortcomings. But it's a completely different season. But I was extremely glad we didn't lose any people to the portal.
The biggest kind of signal to me was when the portal opened initially and the draft waters, you were able to go into them. Damani Jackson, he decided he was going to come back. Deontay Lawson, LT Overton, Tim Keenan, Jeremy Bernard. Those guys, they're invested in the program, and they came back to try to give it another run under Kalen DeBoer. And it signaled to me that Kalen DeBoer had his hands on this program and he had control over it, and these players were playing for him because they love the way he coaches and they're invested in what he's built in just a short time at Alabama. And Courtney Morgan, the impact he's had on Alabama in the 2 years he's been here, like Kalen DeBoer, is immense. It's not as big as Nick Saban had when he got started here, but Courtney Morgan, there is tons of players Alabama would have never even dreamed of getting when Nick Saban retired or even retaining. But Courtney Morgan has been able to bring in new talent, retain guys. It's just him and Kalen DeBoer, their partnership and their construction of this roster and their attainment of players has surprised me, to say the least, from where both of them came from. I mean, Courtney Morgan from Michigan, he was at Washington with DeBoer, and DeBoer from Washington. They didn't have experience coaching and recruiting heavily down here in the South. They've been able to do that to a very high standard that Nick Saban set. So it was encouraging to see when that spring portal opened and closed, there was not a single guy in the portal. Quarterback-wise, that was the big thing. You didn't see Ty Simpson or Austin Mack or Keelon Russell, the three guys that are battling out for quarterback one in the portal. So that was a big sign of encouragement heading into the 2025 season. And before we head into professional football in the NFL draft, if you had to sit here right now, Nathan, spring portal's open and closed. We didn't really get an indication with, like I said, a quarterback hitting the portal. Who do you think would be handed the reins of the quarterback one heading into the first game of the season?
I'm pretty confident that Ty Simpson will get the start. Although Keelon Russell does look impressive, I think his inexperience and him just being young will kind of have him take the back seat. I think he'll end up being the starting quarterback at some point, probably not this season, but further down the line. But I can't ignore what Ty Simpson's been able to do over the course of his career. It's definitely had a big impact, and I think he definitely deserves to have his opportunity, given the fact that he's waited several years in a era that encourages people to leave as soon as things go the other way. So I have a lot of respect for him, and I think he'll do great things. I've always been impressed with the way he's been able to throw the ball, and I don't think he fits into the normal pocket passer stereotype. I think he's able to do a lot more than just that. So I'm ready to see him. And I think he probably placed a bet on it, and that will be Ty Simpson that comes out for the first game.
Yeah, Ty Simpson's, I would argue he's more of an improviser when it comes to that, where Jalen Milroe last season was a scrambler first, then trying to kind of pass her second. Ty Simpson's going to have the ability to throw the ball down the field, intermediate, short, but he's sneaky athletic when it comes to getting outside the pocket, finding the open receiver on the run. So Ty Simpson's going to bring a new aspect to this offense that Kalen DeBoer had with Michael Penix in Washington, where Michael Penix, he had some elusiveness, but that wasn't his first instinct, was let me run outside the pocket. His first instinct was let me read the defense and dot up the defense when it comes to passing. And if I have to get outside the pocket and scramble and try to find the receiver on the run, I'm going to do that. But the last thing I'm going to do is scramble. And in Kalen DeBoer's offense, Ty Simpson is the prototypical quarterback for him and Ryan Grubb. So there's going to be a lot of room for growth for Ty Simpson and the offense under a new offensive coordinator and what's expected to be Ty Simpson. Talking about professional football now, the NFL draft, what I would argue is basically the Shedeur Sanders saga, what it felt like for 3 days. Mel Kiper was on the panel, could not get Shedeur Sanders' name out of his mouth for the entire three-day period that it took for Shedeur to get drafted. Reese Davis had to calm him down and tell him to shut up at one point. Never seen Reese Davis get that heated before somebody on a panel. That shows you how annoying that Mel Kiper was. And I understand Mel Kiper spends a lot of time in the offseason and the regular season scouting these guys, watching film and whatnot, but it got to the point where I had to mute him and turn off the TV almost because he was so annoying. Nathan, we look at the entirety of it, winners, losers, surprise picks. Let's start with the winners here. Who would be your winner of this draft?
It's hard to say. I was really impressed with what the Eagles were able to do, getting Jahan Campbell in the first round. I think that's a big piece. You look at what they've been able to do with the linebacker position, and I think Jahan Campbell really fits that position for him, and they'll be able to really just I was impressed with, what was it? I forget the guy's name. Bond from the Saints. He was on the Saints a few years ago.
Zach Bond,
exactly. What he was able to do with the Eagles this year, I felt like he was more of the X factor on the defense. So I think Jahan Campbell being able to learn from a guy like that and really just adapt to playing that position will be big for the Eagles. And then other teams that were able to fill needs. I looked at what the Jaguars were able to do. Understandably, they did trade up and they did spend a lot of assets. But if Travis Hunter does end up being the guy that people think he can be, I think that will bode well for him. And I'm really not sure what position he's going to primarily play yet. Obviously,
they said mostly receiver to start out with,
which is crazy to me because their huge need is in the secondary. and they already have a great receiver in Brian Thomas Jr. But if he is able to play the two-way like he was in college, then I think that will bode well for him. And then I don't know. I feel like there's no other big team that stood out to me. I felt like every team did a mediocre job at some positions. There were some steals in some rounds, but for the most part, I didn't really have a team that stood out.
I would go the Arizona Cardinals getting Walter Nolan in the first round at pick 16. He had some issues when it came to giving effort, practicing well, and stuff like that. But when he was giving the effort and doing what he needed to do, Walter Nolan was unstoppable at Ole Miss. And if the Cardinals can get him to invest there, try hard, and try every game, he'll be a game wrecker. And it's very hard in this day and age of the NFL to find a game wrecker at the defensive tackle position. You had Aaron Donald, who's now retired, Chris Jones, Vita Vea, arguably, Jonathan Allen, those Jonathan Allen and Vita Vea kind of off and on. Jonathan Allen's career kind of plateauing there, but it's hard to get a good game-wrecking defensive tackle, and Walter Nolan can be that guy. And in the second round, getting Will Johnson, before the draft and before there's injury concerns with his knees, Will Johnson would have been a top 10 pick. There would have been no argument from scouts or anything like that. But with the injury to his knee and the concerns about how it's healing and whatnot, he fell to the second round, and the Cardinals were able to scoop him up. Outside of the Cardinals' pass rushing inabilities last year, their biggest need was their cornerback room. And to get, talent-wise, what was the first or second-best corner in this draft, in the second round, that's a steal, and it makes this draft so much better for the Cardinals. And Jordan Birch in the third round, the edge out of Oregon, could be a diamond in the rough candidate, could help alleviate the pass rushing that the Cardinals didn't have last year. Cody Simon, the linebacker from Ohio State, I mean, he was one of the best middle linebackers in the country last year. Denzel Burke in the fifth round, the corner, he didn't have that great of a year for Ohio State, but Denzel Burke, when he was given the best effort and when he was playing the best he was a couple years ago, he was looked at as a first-round talent. And getting him in the fifth round, again, helps fix the cornerback problem. So the Arizona Cardinals went into this draft, identified the best talent and their needs, and got them. Walter Nolan, Will Johnson, Denzel Burke, Jordan Birch, Cody Simon. I mean, the Cardinals addressed all the needs they needed to do in this draft, and it instills a little bit of confidence in me going into the next season for the Arizona Cardinals. And I kind of prove it year for Kyler Murray and Jonathan Gannon in an NFC West that is an gettable division. Moving on to the losers, Nathan, who do you think lost this draft class?
Saints. Mickey Loomis. Oh, my goodness. I don't understand how he is so employed. I don't get it. I don't get how – even with how bad Shirt Sanders was and how many question marks Jalen Milroe had, he decided to take a 26-year-old quarterback from Louisville, Tyler Shough, and guaranteed probably not like the worst player in the world, but he is 26. He is older than half of the starting quarterbacks in the NFL. What are you trying to get out of him? Not to mention, you said Spencer Rattler was your future, but you won't play him because you still think Derek Carr is your future. What are y'all doing? And then not to mention, I did not agree with the Kelvin Banks pick in the first round. Awful pick. He did not play well late in the season. Even though he had injury issues, I still didn't like the way he played. And then just going through the draft, I saw really no good picks. No good picks whatsoever.
Not even Danny Stutzman?
Not even Danny Stutzman. I think he took a step back last year, honestly, in my opinion, based off the year before that. It's a horrible draft for the Saints. And really, Mickey Loomis is the worst GM in the NFL, and it has been for some time. He makes the Saints look like a laughing stock, and this is why I'm no longer a Saints fan. I cannot do it anymore. I cannot put up with the dumbness that they continue to do. They can't make up their mind on if they're wanting to contend or not. And then they go into the draft, and are we building for the future? Or are we building for right now? We're going to go pick young guys, but then we're going to pick a guy who's 26 years old. I don't know what we're doing. So I'm done. I'm done with the Saints.
You're done? You've completely done with the Saints. What's your new team now, Nathan? You want to
– The Lions. The Lions. And I last year I ended up watching more Lions games than I did Saints games. So the transformation was already complete way before the draft started. but that was definitely like the last straw. That was the cut tie right there.
Nathan is no longer a Saints fan. Can't bring up anything about the Saints anymore. The non-pass interference, anything like that, Nathan? Won't faze you anymore?
Nope.
Well, the loser for me of this draft is the Houston Texans. Horrible draft. You draft two receivers, and I get it, Tank Dell's down probably for the entirety of this upcoming season. You lose Stephon Diggs, but you waste two of your first three picks on receivers from the same team, both from Iowa State, Jaden Higgins and Jalen Noel, where it's obvious what they needed to address. Nathan, could you take a guess what it was?
Offensive line.
It could have been. It could have been.
It would have been pretty helpful.
And they did. They addressed that with Ariante Irsay from Minnesota, the offensive tackle. But you trade Laremy Tunsil in the offseason, and your only answer is to draft a singular offensive lineman with your picks. Just one. I mean, do you want C.J. Stroud to die? He was already struggling last year, and you trade away his best offensive lineman, and your replacement is a rookie. I feel bad for C.J. Stroud, because you can draft all the weapons in the world, but if you can't get the football to him because he's on the ground, eating turf, you're not going to win a football game. The Houston Texans, unlike the Arizona Cardinals, who I talked about earlier, did not address their needs. They just went willy-nilly, and it felt like just picked the best player on the draft board and didn't really go into, okay, C.J. Stroud got sacked way too many times last year. Let's use our picks to address that. No, we're going to draft two receivers. We're going to draft a running back, which we don't need in the fourth round, Woody Marks. Don't know why you draft Woody Marks. Didn't have him on my board. Tons of other running backs available at that point. Graham Mertz over Quinn Ewers. Graham Mertz. Nathan, Graham Mertz.
Yeah, we've seen Graham Mertz play. We've seen enough.
I mean, it's like they were clueless. Jalen Smith in the third round, the cornerback at USC. Haven't seen a lot of tape of him. But again, other good players on the board. It's just, it baffles me how we can have teams like the Arizona Cardinals and the New York Giants identify the needs they have going into the draft and draft them. And then teams like the Houston Texans that just draft what appears like flashy picks and then random picks that just like they're pointing to random people on a draft board. But Woody Marks in the fourth round had him going undrafted. Most people had him going undrafted. Graham Mertz easily could have got him as a UDFA. Easily. Or a person equal to his talent level. But a guy like Quinn Ewers? I mean, if you're going to have no offensive line for C.J. Stroud, go ahead and get a good backup quarterback. Quinn Ewers is that guy. It's Houston Texans' laughable draft. Laughable draft. And we were sitting here years ago when C.J. Or I guess a couple years ago, sorry. C.J. Stroud, next best young quarterback. Well, now he doesn't have an offensive line. The Panthers, unironically, have built a really good team around Bryce Young. I would argue, as of right now, Bryce Young has a better supporting cast and better offensive line going into the next season than C.J. Stroud does. So if Bryce Young can prove himself, that draft day trade for Bryce Young and picking him over C.J. Stroud might not look bad. But that's a big question mark, again, for the Panthers. Kind of talking about a reach with Bryce Young, Nathan, what appears to be, who was your biggest reach in this draft class?
Reach. And you know, I think that the Panthers did reach a little bit with T-Mac. He definitely wasn't projected that high, but I think they filled a need. And that was the biggest thing for me. You look at Bryce Young and what he had to work with wide receiver-wise. You had Adam Thielen, which I was completely surprised he's still in the NFL, given the fact that he's given good minutes, but he is older. And then Xavier Leggett, who could not catch a ball at all last season. that was a big question mark. And really, I thought about, would it be better for the Panthers to, during this offseason, go ahead and trade for a younger wide receiver and give up a little bit more? But no, they went after one in the draft, and I think T-Mac definitely was, in my opinion, the best available wide receiver that they could have gotten. So I was impressed with that. The length of T-Mac, given he's more of a physical target, I think he's going to be a little bit more beneficial for Bryce Young to throw to an easier target. And I'm excited to see how he works out, even though the Panthers do need to keep improving the offensive line. I think that is a big thing. And then the running back position, it's still kind of a question mark, even though you kind of figured some things out last season. Older guys in that position. Did you want to pick up a younger running back? There were some available that they often not to. But I think T-Mac is looked at as a bit of a reach. But if you feel a need, I don't really feel like it's a huge reach.
The biggest reach I look at it as the 49ers taking Mykal Williams 11th overall. Williams is another Trayvon Walker guy where he has all these physical tools, but he didn't show the stats at Georgia. And Trayvon Walker has posted back-to-back double-digit sack seasons. So who's to say Mykal Williams can't do that? But you look at the San Francisco 49ers. It's like the same thing with the Houston Texans. What did the 49ers need? Offensive line. What did the 49ers not address until the seventh round? Offensive line. Mykal Williams could have got a player similar to his talent level later in the draft with production. Mike Green was still available in the second round. Jalen Walker available farther down in the draft. James Pierce. I mean, it's a reach. Not the best player available at that position. Needed other things. 49ers, you're trying to contend. You have a short time until Brock Purdy has to get paid. And your answer is a player that has a lot of raw talent that's not proven yet. Big issue for me for San Francisco reaching for a guy like Mykal Williams. Who is your biggest steal, Nathan?
Well, Mel Kiper would probably want me to say Shedeur Sanders.
I mean, in the first round, or it can be a later round pick.
Gosh, I think that Jalen Milroe will end up being a steal for the Seahawks. I think that
the Bammer.
Yeah, a little bit. But you looked at what all we heard throughout the offseason with how many interviews he did with the Steelers, and he was eventually projected to go in first round in some mock drafts just because he had that high of feedback. He has a lot of athleticism. He's very raw talent. But if you can put the pieces together and get him in the right spot, in the right situation, he can turn out to be a really, really great quarterback. We've seen flashes from it at Alabama. It's not consistent yet. So if the Seahawks can coach him up well and develop him well and put him and surround him with guys that really benefit him and his play style, then he can end up being the tail of the draft. He definitely was one of the more athletic pieces. He resembles a guy in Lamar Jackson. If he can figure out the passing game, the running game is already there. He is a great running quarterback. So I think that makes him a little bit of a steal just because of where they got him. I thought he was probably going to go a little earlier than he did. So I would classify that as a steal. But really, it depends on how well he works out. So it's very conditional.
To have a full circle moment here, you talked about an Alabama player being your steal. My steal is going to be Jahdae Barron from Texas. We talked about Alabama and Texas football in the first part of the show. But the Broncos getting Jahdae Barron at 20th overall, steal. Jahdae Barron has the ability to be and the talent to be one of the best players in this draft class. He was my best corner outside of, I mean, even better than Travis Hunter in the class available. And you look at the Broncos, had the best corner in the NFL. Won defensive player of the year last year in Patrick Surtain. And you get the best corner in college football last year and you put him alongside him. You're not going to complete a pass against the Broncos. And if you do, it's going to be difficult. Getting Jahdae Barron to pair alongside Patrick Surtain, they're going to be the best cornerback duo in the league for years to come. I mean, it was baffling to me that he fell to 20, and I'm sure it baffled Sean Payton and the Broncos that they were sitting there at 20 and a top 10 talent landed in their lap. I don't blame him for going out and getting a player that, while isn't a positional need for the Broncos, could have gone running back. That's what they were rumored to be going after. They go and get a position. They go and get the best player available. And in the first round, I'll never fault a team for getting the best player available. And that's what the Broncos did. Unlike a team like the 49ers who just drafted off raw talent. They didn't go look at either one of the best player available or a team need. They just looked at raw talent and said, I'm in love with this guy. Let me draft him. Broncos steal the draft. And the rest of the draft was pretty good, too. Hugh Robinson in the fourth round.
Yeah, that was a big one.
Another guy that doesn't have the production, but when he was playing, stud.
Mm-hmm.
Stud. So moving on from the NFL draft, Nathan, no more Saints talk, even though you're not a Saints fan anymore. We figured that out today.
It can't hurt me.
Can't hurt you anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about the NBA playoffs, the first round of that, your team, the Oklahoma City Thunder, advanced to the second round. They're playing the Denver Nuggets. The Thunder sweep the Grizzlies 4-0. Denver beats the Clippers 4-3 in a game seven. Minnesota going on to the second round to face the Warriors. Minnesota 4-1, Warriors 4-3. That's the Western Conference, Thunder Nuggets, and then Warriors Timberwolves. In the Eastern Conference, Cavaliers beat the Heat 4-0. Pacers beat the Bucks 4-1. Knicks beat the Pistons 4-2. Boston 4-1. The matchups there are Cavaliers, Pacers, Knicks, Celtics in that second round. But looking at the first round as a whole, Nathan, were you surprised by some of the outcomes, or was it kind of what you predicted going into round two with the matchups?
Looking at the Bucks Pacers series, I thought the Bucks would put up a little bit more fight. Guaranteed, I mean, losing Dame with an injury was very, very terrible. But even with him on the floor, he did not look the same before the injury. They didn't look good. Nothing about the way they played really was good. I guess finding out Gary Trent Jr. could put up 30 points, that's something. Giannis being able to score, we already knew he could do that. But the supporting cast that the Bucks surrounded Giannis with was so poor. And it just made my eyes wait. How do you trade Chris Middleton for Kyle Kuzma? After watching what Kyle Kuzma was able to do, I get Chris Middleton has injury problems, but he is nowhere close as bad as Kyle Kuzma was. And he has the infamous Tony Snell game in the playoffs, putting up 0-0-0-0-0. How are you? What do you play? 22 minutes? How bad is Kyle Kuzma? I think that should be the topic. How bad is Kyle Kuzma? But you lose to the Pacers for the second year in a row. 4-1, you don't look competitive at all. Giannis is probably on his way out the door. What are you going to do this offseason? Are you going to trade him, or are you going to try to sell your soul and surround him with a good cast? I think the Bucks at this point are probably leaning toward trading him and seeing what assets they can get back. And it's sad if you're a Bucks fan, because Giannis has been there the entire time. You watch him grow with the franchise. But I don't see a real way that they can keep Giannis and keep succeeding. I think it's time for them to blow it up and start a rebuild, which is a very, very hard thing to do, given the fact that you're only a few years away from winning an NBA championship. And then looking at another series – the Lakers and the Timberwolves just dominated. It was clear from the jump, I think in game one, that the Timberwolves were the better team. They had the better lineups. Luka and LeBron are just not enough on their own to be able to beat the Timberwolves. And I will say this, LeBron didn't look the same in a lot of the games he played in, a lot of the fourth quarters. I guarantee he was tired. J.J. Redick and the lineups he put out there were very concerning. The game where he played his starting lineup the entire half was very, very, very concerning, and they lost again because of that. I believe LeBron had no points in that fourth quarter, which is a huge thing. Luka, while he is stellar offensively, his defense leaves a lot to be desired. He was picked on a lot of the series. Anthony Edwards picked them apart, and J.J. Redick's decision to double Anthony Edwards the rest of the series and really make the Timberwolves surrounding cast beat them was a horrible decision. I think you got to give Mike Conley a lot of credit, and given how old he is, he was able to come up big. Dante DiVincenzo, he's been stellar. Nikhil Alexander-Walker, he didn't get a lot of playing time, but in the minutes he gave, he was very stellar. And then Jaden McDaniels, he hadn't had 30 points during the regular season at all. And then he comes into the series against the Lakers, has 30 points twice. So that tells you a lot. And then, of course, in the final night, in that fifth game, Rudy Gobert absolutely looked like prime Shaq. I think that really put the nail in the coffin. As a Lakers fan, you have to feel terrible letting someone like Rudy Gobert having that type of offensive input. Rudy Gobert is not that type of player. But you got to give him a lot of credit for what he was able to do in the series. The Lakers' lack of a center really hurt them. And then I also didn't agree with J.J. Redick benching Jason Hayes for the rest of the series. I felt like he was their only option. And when you go and have to move LeBron James to the four instead of allowing him to play the three, it didn't work out. Julius Randle bullied him. And I look at what the Timberwolves were able to do in the series, and Roy looked a lot like last year and where they were. I really thought the Cat trade would hurt them more, but I think Julius Randle has really been a good asset for the team. Not to mention getting Dante DiVincenzo in that trade as well. I feel like those two guys have really stepped up their game, especially going into the playoffs. And it could end up being a win-win for both the Knicks and the Timberwolves going forward. But they got a tough series against the Warriors, who, they had that 3-1 lead, and going as a young Rockets team, it really scared me, because you go and they take the game 7 back to Houston. I thought that was pretty much locked for Houston to be able to advance, but the young and inexperienced Houston Rockets were not able to compete late in that game. You had times where they were able to get that score close, and then the Warriors would go back on a run. I thought that Ime Udoka and his game plan for Stephen Curry was fabulous. I mean, being able to double team and really take him out of the series, and you made other people beat you. But you got to give credit to those people. I think Draymond Green, even with the shenanigans he provided on the court, he really stepped up big offensively. And then a guy named Buddy Hield, who has been quiet all regular season. He had struggled. He comes into the game 7 and goes crazy. And that's exactly what you expect. Brandon Page is empty, young guy. He provides a lot. And then Jimmy Butler, I think, makes this team completely different. I think you look at the point in the regular season before the trade deadline when the Warriors were able to acquire him, and how much he's really changed the Warriors and how they work as a team. He was definitely the right fit, and he is really taking advantage of his time. He's really looked like playoff Jimmy, if you want to say that. And then touching on one last series, I think that you look at what the Thunder have been able to do. And I know this is a little bit of a bias, but you go into a series against a Grizzlies team that I think could have surprised a little bit more. But there was pretty much utter domination. You won in different styles every single night. The game 3, even with Jaw going down, I think people take away from that a little too much. I think that comeback really shows you what kind of team Oklahoma City is, and they don't have that same reliance on Shea as they did last year in the playoffs. Chet and J-Dub being able to step up in those big moments and really provide that scoring output has been huge, but it's been the surrounding cast. It's been the Lou Dorts, the Alex Caruso's, the Cason Wallace's of the team that have stepped up and being able to provide the extra boost, not only on defense, but they're turning that defense into offense. So that's been big for the Thunder, and I'm really excited to see what we have going forward into the next round.
What I take away from the first round of the playoffs is the teams that lost have a lot of reflecting to do. You talk about the Grizzlies. When Ja went down, had about no life for the most part. I know that game 4 was close, but Ja went down, lacked a lot of scoring output. Jaren Jackson Jr. did not play good outside of a few moments here and there. Desmond Bane, Scottie Pippen Jr., I thought, played pretty well. Surprised me, at least, with his ability to play against such a well-oiled machine when it comes to that Thunder defense. They got a lot of inward reflecting to do. Do they continue to build around Ja, or do they reset the thing again and try to find something else where they can get a player that doesn't try to shoot guns on the court, finger guns on the court, and all the shenanigans off the court with Ja. And you look at the Nuggets and the Clippers. Clippers losing that series. After the game, Ty Lue said he wasn't thinking about the offseason. He was thinking about playing the Thunder. You should not be focused on playing the Thunder in the second round. You should have been focused on beating the Nuggets in a game 7.
Mm-hmm.
Just a thought for Ty Lue there. But the Clippers, James Harden, Kawhi Leonard aren't getting any older. Kawhi Leonard, we know, struggles with injuries year after year. Norman Powell at the beginning of the year was the best player on the roster. that was playing in the early part of the season, suffered an injury, kind of tapered off. Expected him to kind of figure it out in this series and help out Kawhi and James Harden. He didn't. They don't have Ivica Zubac. While he's great, he has his moments where he's doesn't have an impact on the game. It's hard to have an interior center in this day and age of the NBA, and that's what Zubac is. Clippers have a lot of reflecting to do. Your roster, you have the oldest roster in the NBA. You don't have first-round picks for a long while. You can thank Zampressi for that, for finessing you out of all those picks, and Shai Gilgeous-Alexander. A lot of inward reflecting for them. The Lakers, Luka, great foundational piece, great piece going forward. LeBron only has a year or two left. Outside of those guys, what you got? Austin Reeves, no show in the playoffs. Jackson Hayes gets benched. Dorian Finney-Smith, he picks and chooses when he wants to score points. Rui Hachimura is off and on. Gabe Vincent, overpaid trash. I mean, you have Bronny James, you're going to put him out there? Don't connect, must have done something because he got put in doghouse. What you got, Lakers, outside of Luka and 41-year-old LeBron?
J.J. Redick's actually going to suit up next time. Don't worry.
The Rockets, where's Jabari Smith?
Oh, my goodness. Jabari Smith in the entire series. The defense was horrible. The offensive output left a lot to be desired. And it's not just him. Alfred Sengun, good Lord. I mean, how in the world can he not score every Draymond Green? You get all the way down there in the post, and it's like he forgets what he's doing. Fred VanVleet, he has his moments. Jalen Green, I mean, that's a trash can right there.
Jordan Poole? Talking about Jordan Poole?
He's worse than Jordan Poole is. I've seen Jordan Poole put up points. I've seen Jordan Poole know how to score. Now, Jalen Green doesn't know how to do any of that. He knows how to jump. You know who I feel bad for? I feel bad for Amin Thompson. That's who I feel bad for.
He played like a stud.
Yeah, he did. But when you get paired with a bunch of people who don't know what's going on, I'm sure he's frustrated. What do the Rockets do moving forward? I don't think they have the right pieces in place.
No, it's a weirdly constructed roster. You look at Amin Thompson, Sengun, Jabari Smith comes off the bench for some reason, third overall pick. It's just weirdly constructed. Reed Shepard doesn't play. He was a top three pick last year. I mean, it's a situation where you have a lot of talent, but you haven't used the talent to the potential they should be used. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of hard to manage that. I mean, you saw with the Pelicans when they traded AD. They got all this influx of talent and didn't really know how to use it. And they had to blow it up. The Thunder, they got an influx of young talent, have all these draft picks, but they know how to use it. So there's situations all around the league where you get young talent, you don't use it properly, and you don't figure it out. And you have teams like the Thunder. And it's not to say the Rockets didn't figure it out because they're the second seed in the Western Conference. It just got to the point in the playoffs where their weaknesses were magnified. Jalen Green's inconsistency, Jabari Smith, no defense, Fred VanVleet inconsistent, Alperen Sengun, no defense, can't finish on the inside. A lot of young pieces. And when you get to the playoffs, youth can be an Achilles heel. And it was for the Rockets against the Warriors, too. The Warriors have people that have won NBA championships and have been to the NBA finals. And before we end the show here, Nathan, talking about some of the Eastern Conference teams you didn't talk about that ended up losing their series, Miami Heat, worst team in the playoffs. Worst team by far. I mean, they put up no fight against the Cleveland Cavaliers. Need to tear it down. Pat Riley needs to get out of his office and start making some trades. Not Tyler Hero's and Bam Adebayo about the only things on that roster going forward. And you could argue Tyler Hero's what wasn't great. That's not, game four was terrible. Bam Adebayo can't do everything. You talked about the Bucks, Nathan, how they need to kind of address that going forward. The Pistons.
I thought the Pistons were
bright,
good.
The future is bright for the Pistons. Cade Cunningham figured it out. Sar Thompson.
Great defense.
Just like his brother, Jalen Duren. Malik Beasley. I mean, yeah. Great three-point architect.
Get rid of Tim Hardaway Jr. You got yourself a roster.
Yeah, and then Jaden Ivey. He didn't play. He was out with an injury all year. And Jaden Ivey is good. So the Pistons have a lot for them going forward. I don't really think there's an issue with that roster for next season. Really don't. I mean, maybe outside of trading Tim Hardaway Jr. And then the Magic, get a guard.
Get someone who can shoot the ball for the love. I was tired of them shooting as many threes as they did. They had the worst 3-point percentage all year long, and they decided we're not going to go away from it. We're going to continue to fire and continue to fire until they go down. And if I had to watch KCP and Franz Wagner shoot up another brick, I don't think I could have had that TV anymore. It was that bad.
Well, Jalen Suggs, another player missing in the playoffs due to injury. So I don't think he makes an impact in the series for them to beat the Celtics. Need to go get a dominant one or somebody that can pass and shoot the ball effectively.
You need to get a playmaker. Black, yeah. Something.
They need a true PG. True. Jalen Suggs is not a true point guard. He's a two. Corey Joseph's not the answer at point guard.
Cole Anthony?
No. Anthony Black's not. The Magic are about one or two pieces away from contending in the Eastern Conference. Paolo has proven he's a franchise player. Franz Wagner has shown flashes, even though he had some struggles. He's shown flashes to be a third best option on a team, if that second best option that they get for Paolo is as good as he should be. So Magic's another team where they're a couple pieces away from being really, really good in the Eastern Conference. Well, it wraps up our show today. Thank you for listening and watching Students of the Game.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.